Welcome to RTB Live Extra, a new podcast brought to you by Reasons to Believe. This week, we'll answer science faith questions we didn't get to during this week's RTB Live broadcast. If you want to catch the show live, tune in on Thursdays at 1 p.m. Pacific on the Reasons to Believe YouTube channel.
Well, we've got about a dozen questions for the podcast today. And the first one is from Renee. He says, I have questions about the theory that the Earth is flat. Where is this theory coming from? Are these theories totally hoax? This is an interesting question, one I've been asking myself, because about three decades ago, I debated the president of the Flat Earth Society. The debate only lasted 5 minutes because he bowed out once he found out that I was an astrophysicist, and this society disappeared, but it's come back. And the real question is, why is this coming back? I mean, what's going on that we got people actually believe that the Earth is flat? And I wrote an article on this for my Facebook page, basically making the point that what's been happening with the internet is we have a lot of people who claim to be experts that are not experts that are speaking on scientific issues. And the result is we have a lot of lay people who don't trust what scientists are saying. So when scientists say there's overwhelming physical evidence that the Earth is not flat, that it's spherical, they say, well, we believed you in the past. Why should we believe you now? So I think that explains why the latest polls show that 7% of adult Americans actually believe that the Earth is flat. And 3 years ago, nobody was believing that the Earth is flat. So I think there's more of a just the fact that we have a lot of people not really figuring out who the real experts are. That's why I actually wrote a blog a few weeks ago making the point, how do you know how to evaluate what you see on the internet or what you hear in different public media? Basically making the point that when you see an article on a scientific discovery, if the journalist or the interviewer has not given you a citation to a peer-reviewed scientific article, I would not trust what they're saying. The really good science journalists out there always give you the source, a credible peer-reviewed source for what they're writing. So that's missing. I'd be careful. And you can go to the article I wrote. I basically show you a number of ways of putting to the test claims that you're hearing on TV, radio, through the internet, Facebook, Twitter. And as it tells us in the Bible, test everything, hold fast to that which is good. So I think another explanation why we have all this flat earth stuff going on, people have lost the capacity or the willingness or the desire to test what's being presented in front of them. And are all these theories trying to defend a flat earth hoaxes? Well, I wouldn't say they're all hoaxes, but none of them are valid. And I've been actually quite busy trying to help people be reassured that the Earth is not flat, that it really is spherical. I mean, just simple things like the fact that when you look at a distant mountain, you see the top of the mountain, not the bottom of the mountain. If the world was flat, you'd be able to see the bottom as well as the top. But my favorite one is take a flight from Athens down to Johannesburg, take the flight at night, get a window seat, look out the window, and you'll see the constellations, the stellar constellations, slowly turn upside down as you cross the equator. That only happens if the Earth is approximately spherical. A flat Earth, that would not happen. But again, I've written on this. You can go to my Facebook page and see many more evidences. To me, it's a symptom, too, that we now live at a time when people can get a bachelor's degree from a university without taking any courses on physics. And people can graduate from high school without taking a senior year physics class. So I'm not surprised that people do not have the physics background to realize how impossible it is that we live on a flat earth. Weinbrenner asks three questions. I'll try to get to each three fairly quickly. First off, he says, mass extinctions involve flora and fauna at different or same time or the event. So he's asking a question about to what degree do mass extinctions affect the plant and the flora and fauna of the Earth, and it depends on the mass extinction event. Some mass extinction events literally wipe out 90 to 95% of all the species on the face of the Earth. The Permian mass extinction event was at that level, for example. But most mass extinction events are at the level of about 50%. Some are below that. And yes, some of them do target different life forms. For example, if you were to get a nearby radio burst, what that would do is it would shower our planet with intense deadly radiation for a few seconds to a few minutes, but then it would be over. And so that particular mass extinction event would be marked by life being wiped out on one hemisphere, but not on the opposite hemisphere. And again, it depends on what's responsible for the mass extinction event. And Weinbrenner asks a follow-up, do the 30 to 35 million year cycles occur because Earth gets out of its plane to the limits? I've addressed this in Improbable Planet, making the point that as the Earth, as the solar system, revolves around the center of our galaxy, that takes about 250 million years for the sun and its planets to make one circuit around the center of our galaxy. But as it makes that circuit, the sun and its planets move up and down relative to the plane of the galaxy. And so when it's right into the plane of the galaxy, it's protected by dust. So it shields it from radiation from the black hole, but it's also a place where you're going to be exposed to dense molecular clouds. And so as the sun moves up and down relative to the plane of our galaxy, when it goes through the plane, it gets closer to massive stars and massive molecular clouds. And these will disturb the five asteroid and comet belts in our solar system. And when they're disturbed, we get a rain of comets and asteroids pelting the inner solar system. And most mass extinction events we see in the fossil record, at least those we can study in some detail, like the ones over the past 600 million years, what we notice is that they're predominantly driven by major asteroids and comets striking the Earth. And we pass through the plane of our galaxy about once every 33 million years. So that's right on target with a 30 to 35 million year cycle. But you'll see more details and citations in Improbable Planet. Weinbrenner asked one more question. How does the cloud cover the Earth change? Because I made the point that depending what kind of life you have on planet Earth, that life can affect the cloud cover. And life affects the cloud cover by the amount of water it transpires to the atmosphere, particularly with the advanced plants. They transpire a lot of water through their leaves. And so, for example, the Amazon jungle, ecologists estimate that about half the rainfall can be attributed to the transpiration of water from the plants in the jungle. And that will affect the clouds. And also, life will release certain chemicals into the atmosphere. Now, for example, there's a lot of natural smog caused by plants and trees in particular. And it's thanks to ozone in the troposphere that we don't get polluted by all the smog particles produced by plants and trees in particular. But they also have an impact on the cloud cover. And so depending which kind of plants you have in the surface here, how many of those plants, what kind of plants, that will affect the cloud cover. And different kinds of clouds will reflect more or less sunlight. So if you got greater cloud cover, you got the opportunity of reflecting more sunlight than would otherwise be the case. And the kinds of clouds can have an impact there as well. Okay, a question from BD Mosejord. I'm sorry about how I'm pronouncing that. Mosejord, I guess, is the correct pronunciation. It says in the year 1400 AD, there are only about 350 million people on the Earth. Today, there's close to 8 billion people. Is the fact that we're close to 8 billion people, is this a sign of the soon return of Jesus? Well, it's somewhat of a sign. I mean, what you see in Revelation chapter 7, verse 9, is that there will be an uncountable number of people in heaven from all the nations, people groups, and tribes praising God. And so that's an indication that there will be an uncountable number of people from every people group on the face of the earth that will be part of the redeemed host praising God in heaven. And as I mentioned in today's talk, the Greeks had a number system that went up to a billion. So when I talk about being an uncountable number, that means at least several billion people. And so, yes, I use that as an explanation for why God designed our planet in such a way that it can sustain billions of people at one time. And so, yes, today we've got enough people on planet Earth that that prophecy could be fulfilled. On the other hand, what we see in Revelation 7:9, it gives us a lower limit on how many people will be saved, but not an upper limit. And we don't know how many billions of people God intends to save. But I would say the real sign of the return of Christ, we have the promise in the book of Acts chapter 1 and Matthew chapter 28, last chapter of Matthew, that Jesus will return once his followers, his disciples here on planet Earth, bring a large fraction of people to faith in Christ and every people group on planet Earth. And actually gives us an indication of how large a fraction he's talking about. Zechariah chapters 12 through 13 indicate that before the return of Christ, a third of the Jews living in the world will become followers of Jesus Christ. And Jesus himself said it would never be a majority. Narrow is the way that leads to salvation. And so it's not going to be a majority of human beings that receive Jesus Christ as Creator, Lord, and Savior, but neither will it be a small minority. I believe it's going to be a large minority. And I've argued in Improbable Planet, the last chapter, chapter 16, that we're getting close in the sense that we're looking at about 15 to 20% of the world's population being serious Bible-believing Christians. And whenever it gets to 25 to 35%, and it gets extended to all the people groups of the planet, that likely will be the fulfillment. But we see in Matthew, as well as what we see in Revelation and in the book of Acts. And so I argue that already Christians on planet Earth have the money, they've got the people numbers, and they got the technology to bring about the fulfillment of taking the good news of Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world, so that a large fraction would be committed followers of Jesus Christ. We have the capacity to fulfill that in just one decade. All we lack is a motivation, but we do significantly lack the motivation. So it's basically in our hands when Jesus will return. I've argued that rather than waiting for the Lord to return, the Lord is waiting for us to complete the job that he gave us. Judy Stallings asked this question: is there an estimate as to where Earth currently is in the extinction speciation cycle? Yes, we are not in the plane of our galaxy right now, but we are headed towards the plane of the galaxy. And I forget the exact number of millions of years we got to go before we hit there. So it's not going to be in the immediate future. And the sun will be too bright for human beings to exist on the Earth before we enter that time when we'll be exposed to another major extinction event. So, yeah, I talk about this in Improbable Planet, about the different things that will bring about the end of humanity and which of those events are likely to happen first. Yevon, our biologist, asked this question: Dr. Ross, why do Jews who can read Hebrew also have a young earth creation opinion, though knowing that young can mean a long, definite period of time? Interesting question, Yevon, because it's not just we Christians who have a young earth, old earth debate. It's also evident in Judaism, and also it's evident in Islam. So in Islam as well, they have this young earth, old earth debate. After all, we see in Islam that they borrow creation texts from the Bible. The Islamic faith is basically somewhat like Mormonism in that they take the Old New Testament and they add a latter-day revelation to it. So we shouldn't be surprised that they have some of the same issues that we're dealing with. And I think we make a mistake in thinking that all Bible-believing Jews are fluent in Hebrew. I've known a lot of Orthodox Hebrews, Orthodox Jews over the years, and I've been surprised how many of them in their services, their synagogue services, repeat these Hebrew phrases from the Old Testament over and over again, but they actually don't know what they're repeating. And I remember one time I was at a weekend event with several Orthodox and conservative Jews, and they were just telling us the Hebrew that they repeat in their services. But we asked them if they knew what it meant, and they said no, they had no idea. So we who are Protestant Christians had to explain to them the Hebrew that they were repeating. And when they actually found out the Hebrew that they were repeating, they were basically shocked at the similarities it had with the doctrines of the Christian faith. So some Jews are fluent in Hebrew, but just like here in Christianity, the vast majority are not. So we shouldn't be surprised that they may be somewhat ignorant of the fact that the Hebrew word for day, yom, has four distinct literal definitions. On the other hand, as I share with Muslims and Jews and Christians, there are lexicons that make it easy for an English language reader or a reader of any other language to quickly determine the range of possible definitions for these Hebrew words. And in the 21st century, most of us are speaking big vocabulary languages. I think it's crucial that we communicate biblical Hebrew as a very small vocabulary, only 3,000 words if you don't count the names of people and cities. And therefore, we shouldn't at all be surprised that Hebrew nouns, almost every one of them, have multiple literal definitions. Mike Sten asks this question: is increased carbon dioxide production causing warming, or is the sun just burning hotter? Well, the sun is burning hotter, but it's burning hotter at a very, very slow rate. It literally takes a few million years before you notice any difference. Recognize that graph I showed you. It took 3.8 billion years for the sun to get just 22% brighter. So yeah, typically you're not going to notice anything significant until the sun is at least a half percent hotter, and that won't happen for several more million years. And so the amount of greenhouse gases we're putting in the atmosphere has a much more dramatic effect on warming the surface of the Earth than anything that's happening with the sun. I mean, a lot of people have said, what about the solar cycle? Yes, there's an 11-year solar cycle, but the impact it has on the temperature of the Earth, it's below 0.1%. So again, human activity has a much more dramatic effect. Likewise, the natural cooling is much more dramatic. Right now, we're at a point in the history of the Earth where the changing tilt of our rotation axis and the changing shape of the orbit of the Earth about the sun is driving global cooling. And that global cooling has been mitigated by human activity. However, in the last 70 years, human activity has now accelerated where it's outstripping the natural cooling that's occurring as a result of our rotation axis tilting back towards 22.1 degrees away from 24.5, and likewise the orbit about the sun becoming less elliptical. Chong Ho Yu asks the question, does COVID-19 slow down climate change due to less industry and travel? COVID-19 has had an impact in that people aren't traveling as much. And so since they're not traveling as much, a lot less greenhouse gases are being released in the atmosphere. It's had a small effect. We may be looking at maybe a 10 or 20% effect at most. So it's not enough, although a lot of people said, hey, we can just sustain everybody staying at home. That will drop transportation carbon dioxide release enough that it will make a difference. It will make a difference, but not a sufficient difference. And moreover, I don't think it's sustainable. People do like to travel and meet one another. So I think as soon as this pandemic begins to lessen, you're going to see people traveling a lot more than they did before. On the other hand, I do think there's going to be some permanent outcomes to this pandemic, in the sense that people are realizing that at least certain individuals are more productive traveling less. And so if you've got employees, for example, that are highly motivated and don't need to be monitored, you might actually encourage them to work at home rather than come to the office every day. The fact that they don't have to deal with heavy traffic actually means that they got more energy to do their work. And the fact that they save all that commute time means they got more time to complete their work. And so that's something we've been noticing with this pandemic. It's actually made some of our workers more productive. On the other hand, has made some of our workers less productive, particularly workers who don't produce well when they're not being closely supervised. Although it's also interesting, thanks to new technology, supervisors have found ways to supervise their employees even when they're not in front of them face-to-face. And so just simply requiring people to be constantly available for internet meetings and internet checkups. So I do think we're going to see some positive outcomes come from this pandemic. But it's not going to be a major change, but it will help. Well, that takes care of all the questions that we got from today's R2B Live. And in future, we'll continue to do this. So please subscribe to the Reasons to Believe podcast. When you do that, you'll be alerted to all the times we release these audio podcasts that supplement what we're doing through our video podcast. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.